These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Will 2018 be the year that New Hampshire turns the corner on a drug epidemic that has seemed out of control? That's the hope that after more than 5 years of escalating addiction and deaths, public and private efforts will start to pay off. Certainly, policies and funding have changed since the Granite State found itself in the grip of a drug addiction crisis. The question is whether these changes are enough to make a difference. Today in The Exchange, a broad look at how New Hampshire has tackled this issue with two people who followed it closely. Later in the hour, we'll talk with NHPR's Paige Sutherland. She's done a lot of reporting on this. We begin with David Mara. 6 months after he was appointed the governor's advisor on addiction and behavioral health, or in shorthand, the state's drug czar. Now, Mara comes to the job with a background in law enforcement, 30 years on the Manchester Police Force, retiring as chief and serving briefly as interim chief in Portsmouth. Let's get you into our conversation, too. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477, or you can respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. And Chief Mara, welcome back. It's really good of you to be here.
It's great to be back.
Well, it's staggering when you think about what's been happening in just the past 5 or 6 years. And I was thinking about it last night and, you know, just hundreds of Granite Staters dying annually from drugs. CDC says we now have the nation's third highest overdose death rate. My first question for you, Chief Mara, why New Hampshire? You know, we're in the top 10 in terms of per capita income. We've got low unemployment. Our residents are well educated. There are a lot of metrics that make New Hampshire look pretty good. So what gives?
I think it all comes down to the New Hampshire has always had higher percentage of alcohol use or drug use, opioid prescriptions issued. And I think it has a lot to do with perhaps that, but in my opinion, I think it has to do with the availability, the cheap prices, and the proximity to Lawrence, Massachusetts. And I don't want to pick on Lawrence, but approximately 80% of our opioid based drugs come from there. And I think it has to do with that. And it we went through in New Hampshire what the rest of the country went through. We had in the 90s the pharmaceutical companies, Purdue in particular, marketed OxyContin, said it wasn't addicted. Then we had the medical profession started treating pain as a vital sign. And a lot of prescriptions were issued. A lot of pills were out there. And what happened is that people started getting addicted. They would get an injury. Somebody might go in for an injury, and they are prescribed opioids. The injury goes away, but there was nothing done about the addiction. And then, of course, there's stories out there about kids getting into prescription, their parents' prescription drugs, their grandmothers, grandparents. And then there's other people that, that tried it, used it, and they got addicted. And then after that happened, it was very expensive. Rule of thumb, this in New Hampshire, we started seeing it really in 2013, where we started seeing an uptick in property crimes. And people, when we dug into it, what's happening here, we found that it was people that were buying pills now because they couldn't get a prescription, and they were buying it on the street. Rule of thumb at the time was a dollar a milligram. It got very expensive. They went through their resources. They went through their friends and family's resources, and then they resorted to crime. And then in 2014, almost overnight, it turned to heroin. And you know, basically what happened to the Mexican cartels, they decided this is a good opportunity to flood the market with cheap heroin. And people that would never think of sticking a needle in their arm, they found that this was a cost-effective method to be able to feed their addiction. What I have found is that this addiction to opioids is insidious, and once people get addicted, they go through this whole cycle of trying to get high, and then by the end, it's what I've learned is that they're not so much taking opioids to get high, they're taking it so they don't get sick.
And the narrative that you just presented has been told in states around the country, especially in the Northeast and the upper Midwest. But my question really is New Hampshire. And so you seem to say part of it is location. We're near this major center. We've got this I-93. Part of it, though, you said New Hampshire's always had higher rates of, you know, alcohol use, drug dependence. What's behind that, Chief? I just wonder what you think.
That I don't have an answer to that. I do know there's a simple answer why at this time New Hampshire has, we're third per capita 100,000 population as far as overdose deaths. I do know it's a simple answer to that I talked to previously about how in 2014 it turned almost overnight to heroin, and then in 2015, by the time I left Manchester, we were finding it was all for the most part fentanyl.
Which is very deadly.
Fentanyl is deadly, and it was again another business decision by the Mexicans. And what they did is they changed to fentanyl. So when fentanyl is, by the time it makes it up to this area, when the street level the drug dealers, the ones that have distributed it to the street level drug dealers, when they mix it, they're cutting it. Well, you don't know what they're mixing it with. They're mixing it in blenders, and it's. You might get a portion out of the amount that is sold that might be all cut or what it's mixed with, or you might get that it's almost all fentanyl. There's no exact science, and so that is why we're getting these overdoses. It's cheap, it is readily available, and it's deadly. People do not know what they're shooting into their arms or whatever way they're ingesting it.
I want to remind our listeners that we're sitting down with David Mara. He's the governor's advisor on addiction and behavioral health, or the drug czar. Mara was previously Manchester's police chief and served for a time as interim police chief in Portsmouth. You can join us with your comments and questions. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. If you have personal experience with this drug crisis yourself, or if you just want to question or comment on what New Hampshire is doing to tackle this, we'd love to hear from you. Again, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So I just mentioned your background there, Chief Mayor, in law enforcement. And I have to call you Chief Mayor because I've called you that for so many interviews past. How do you see this new role? Are you advocating for policies or funding, or are you more overseeing and coordinating? How do you see it?
I see my role as advisor to the governor. I see my role is to really get to know what is going on throughout the state, what is working, what isn't, what is needed, and then reporting that back in, and also taking a look at where are the problems throughout the state. Like every state that is now in the same boat as us. When this thing hit, when it first hit, of course, police departments, emergency rooms, EMS, they first started seeing it happen. When it really came about, we did not, New Hampshire, have the capacity to handle it, like many states. So at this point, what we're trying to do is fill the gaps. We're trying to look from the time somebody seeks help to the time that they get out of treatment and then go start recovery. We have to make sure we fill the gaps to get people the help they need, the services they need, and to make sure that if they have a relapse, that they just get right back into that continuum of care.
What have you learned in this job for 6 months? Again, this drug crisis was not unfamiliar to you. You saw it firsthand as police chief in Manchester and then for a time in Portsmouth. But what have you learned in this new role?
What I've learned is that this has affected the state economically. It's affected the cost of medical care. But most importantly, that I've seen that this has really impacted families. And that is something that we're going to be dealing with for a while. And we have to make sure that we really start focusing on prevention as well. Because right now, as we're trying to get people that are already suffering from addiction, we're already trying to get them help, but now we have to save the next generation. So we have to make sure we're starting earlier. We have to encourage parents to talk to the kids and continue talking to their kids. And don't assume that you can talk to them once. You have to continue the conversation in a way where they're going to engage you. We have to be able to reach out to kids in the way that they listen. Kids don't listen to watch TV. They don't watch commercials. The governor had a conversation. He was telling me he had a conversation with a young man, and he said, I don't watch the news. I don't watch TV. I didn't know any of this was going on. So we have to listen to what the kids are saying. So we have to go to them in the medium that they'll understand and listen to us.
As we talk about the state response and what you're trying to bring to this, let's talk a little bit, Chief Mayor, about the federal response. And I want to play a clip from President Trump's State of the Union address Tuesday night. Let's hear what he had to say about the federal approach toward the opioid crisis.
In 2016, we lost 64,000 Americans to drug overdoses. 174 deaths per day, 7 per hour. We must get much tougher on drug dealers and pushers if we are going to succeed in stopping this scourge. My administration is committed to fighting the drug epidemic and helping get treatment for those in need, for those who have been so terribly hurt.
Again, that's President Trump addressing the opioid crisis in his State of the Union address. To that first part of that little clip we played there, Chief Mayor, how much does getting tougher on drug dealers help?
It does help. You hear people say, well, no matter you arrest one drug dealer, there's going to be two to take the place. But you have to keep up the enforcement. If you don't, New Hampshire will be friendly to drug dealers. They'll move up here. There will be no incentive for them to stay out of our state. So we are really going after the drug dealers. We are really trying to stop the drugs flowing from the Massachusetts border or all our borders. Enhanced our capability to do highway intervention, and we have a granite shield. It used to be granite hammer, where it's funding where officers from different departments group together in particular areas, and they learn about how to do drug addiction. They learn how to do drug investigations, and what that does is it saves resources. Most departments, New Hampshire's a state where the vast majority of police departments don't have the manpower. So this is great where they can pool their resources and get out there and try to stop the flow of drugs from coming in.
It sounds like you've heard this argument before that, you know, basically going after drug dealers is a game of whack-a-mole. You whack one down, another one pops up. And it sounds like you're saying, I understand that. On the other hand, we can't just let it run apace.
We could turn into this. There are cities out there that are overrun by people that sell drugs. And we don't want that to happen to any of our towns and cities in New Hampshire.
It's interesting. The police chief in Merrimack recently, Denise Roy, went before the town and said, look, I need more people because they're starting to see drugs pop up in a more significant way, including meth, I believe, Denise Roy said. Let's just hear a little bit from Merrimack Chief of Police Denise Roy on the impacts of drug addiction in her town.
So it's almost like a free-for-all. Come to Merrimack. You can do anything you want. There's three officers. Maybe one of them will catch you. That's not the perception we want to give. We want people that are involved in this lawless activity to know you cannot go to Merrimack because they are on top of it.
Okay, so again, that's Denise Roy, Merrimack Chief of Police. And today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with David Mara, former police chief in Manchester. Today, he is Governor Sununu's drug czar, formerly known as the governor's advisor on addiction and behavioral health. And let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go first to Leinster, Chief Mara, and Dorothy's on the line from there. Hi, Dorothy. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just wondering, you are talking about the fentanyl being added in Mexico. And we have drug gangs up here, too. And I'm wondering if, in the United States, I mean, and I'm wondering what if there's any evidence that it is all done in Mexico or if it might not be done, some of it might not be done up here also.
Dorothy, thank you for the question.
The vast majority that we are getting here does come from Mexico, from talking to the DEA. But
it's the Drug Enforcement Administration. Yeah.
Yes. But you can get fentanyl. People do get it through the mail. They order it. Sometimes it comes directly from China.
I heard about China as another source. Go ahead.
Well, China actually sends it to Mexico. But there are different ways that it does come in. It doesn't just come from Mexico.
Thank you for the question, Dorothy. Let's take another one. This is Rick in Center Ossipee. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Fine.
Nice to talk to David. I was nice to see David at our open house at Whitehorse Addiction Center. My comment today has to do with detox primarily. And the problem with detox that we have is that there are no detox centers in New Hampshire, or very few. We have Farnham Center and a few others. But when a client comes in and they're looking for detox, the hospitals are not part of the answer. They've washed their hands of trying to detox people for various reasons. And so in my opinion, the doctors, the MDs who got people addicted in the first place, I don't want to blame them on that. I want to blame the pharmacies for not telling the whole truth about the addictiveness of OxyContin. But it seems to me the doctors need to be part of the solution to help people with what's called ambulatory detox and detoxing at home so that they can get off the drugs safely by working with their physician. And the problem that I'm finding is that the physicians haven't got a clue about how to detox people.
Okay, and Rick,
so,
and I'm going
to
let you go. Just sure, in the interest of time, I got to let you go, Rick. I apologize. But go ahead, Chief Mara.
There is a change of attitude within a medical community. And what we're trying to do on the state level is to encourage and try to get more doctors to get certified to be able to participate in medicine-assisted treatment. And those, if it's proven if you do that with treatment, it's proven that its success rate is higher than just treatment itself. So, but going up to Whitehorse, I was very impressed with the dedicated people that are up there. Unfortunately, the farther north you go, the less resources that you have in there, like throughout the state. I went there, I was very impressed. They have plans they want to expand. They're really taking a stake in the community, trying to help out. And there are people like that throughout the state. And it's just a matter of time. We're a small enough state. If we get enough people like that, there will be an impact.
Well, glad you called, Rick. And that segues perfectly into what we'll talk about after a short break, Chief Mara. What New Hampshire's treatment infrastructure looks like now, what it should look like, in your opinion, and how hard it is to get from A to B. We'll keep taking your questions and comments as well. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. The This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, we're looking at New Hampshire's drug addiction crisis. With us in the studio now is David Mara. He's the governor's advisor on addiction and behavioral health. In shorthand, the state's drug czar. Let's definitely hear from you. Have you experienced this issue personally? How do you see the response here in the state or in your own community? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Chief Mara, let's talk about the drug treatment infrastructure. And the national press has done stories on New Hampshire. How have we been hit so hard in this crisis? CNN, NBC, USA Today. And often mentioned in this coverage, Chief, is the fact that we don't have the treatment capacity in place to deal with it, that drug treatment has always been hard to come by in this state. So when this whole opioid crisis thing blew up, New Hampshire was especially vulnerable. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it played into it, yes. I think that when it did hit, when people were asking for treatment at the time, they weren't able to find it. And it was a problem. We could build right now, hypothetically, if we would build a 50-bed facility somewhere, a big facility, we would not be able to staff it at this point, because another problem that New Hampshire is the workforce. We are having a problem hiring people in the profession, doctors, LADACs, nurse practitioners, because we're in competition with Massachusetts, which pays higher. And so we're trying to work on that with loan repayment program. We're trying to recruit people to come up here, and it is a battle. It's before this happened, it was difficult to do, but now that they're in such demand, these professionals in such demand, it's even more difficult. So what the governor has advocated this is that we, within our state, we try to keep the people that get training here, that get their education in the profession here, and try to retain them and keep them here.
So a LADAC, by the way, licensed alcohol and drug abuse.
Drug and alcohol.
Counselor, and certainly employers in all fields tell us that they struggle to find qualified employees. A week or two ago, we talked to folks who work with abused and neglected children, and they said they didn't have enough people. So how much does a substance abuse counselor typically make, Chief Mara?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but I have heard that it is lower than what Massachusetts and the national average.
And a stressful job. And are there licensing requirements that get in the way also of expanding this workforce that, you know, let's say someone was trained in Mass or Vermont or Maine and they wanted to work in New Hampshire, but licensing requirements got in the way? Is that another thing gumming up the works?
Yes, it is. And that's another thing that the state is working on, trying to, if somebody's in Massachusetts and say they were a LADAC, nurse practitioner, whatever it is, and they've had experience, they're licensed there. Right now, the way it stands in a lot of these positions is that people have to jump through a lot of hoops. They have to get licensed here. It takes a while. It could be costly, and we need people right away. And we don't want to people to say, "Hey, I don't want to go through that process," and not even apply anywhere up here. So that's another thing that we are working on.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Chief Mara, let's go back to the phones and to Tiffany in Concord. Hi, Tiffany. Welcome. Go ahead.
Hey there. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you so much, Chief Mara, for what you have to say so far. I wanted to comment quickly on substance abuse counselors' pay. I actually have a background in that and am unable to work in this field because it's below kind of the living wage, anywhere from $11 to $16 an hour. And the second point I wanted to ask is that we're doing great things for prevention at this point, but with the heavy hand of the criminalization that's going on, how do you see, chronic pain patients being affected by this? And, are there any advocacy, kind of support things in the work for those patients that are now in need of this, but being such adversely affected?
Tiffany, thank you so much. And we did a whole program a week or two ago, I think, on how chronic pain patients fit into this. But go ahead, Chief Mara, thoughts there.
I think it's that is something that we really have to depend on the medical profession, the medical field to do. They know their patients, and if somebody is suffering from chronic pain, or if somebody is if somebody is suffering from a cancer in his there are no efforts to stop those people from getting pain medication. What we're trying to do as a state is to try to stop doctors prescribing opioids for strep throat and minor things, for giving a month's worth of pills.
Does that still go on, Chief Mara?
Not as much. Not as much. There's a requirement now that it's a 7-day prescription. In the past, that has been an issue where, you know, since I've had this job, there have been a few occasions. But I think in New Hampshire, they're getting better. They're being trained. They're being getting education. That this is how a lot of this started. I might be misquoting the stat, but I read somewhere 80% of people that end up using heroin or fentanyl, they started out with prescription drugs, abusing prescription drugs. So that is something that we really have to keep an eye on.
Well, and that relates to an email we got from Molly, who says, your position is the advisor on addiction and behavioral health. How have you connected with the medical community, and what is the message that you bring to them regarding the care of people in our state? So you're sort of touching on it, but if you want to address Molly's question.
There are a lot of hospitals and doctors in New Hampshire that get it, and they are on the forefront. And I do talk to the hospitals. I participate in events that they have. I've made presentations, so I'm trying to stay in tune with everything that this issue touches. Every person, every profession. And they play a big role in this, and because if they're not on board, all our efforts could be for naught. But I believe in New Hampshire, what I'm seeing, they certainly are on board.
And when you talked earlier about the success of medication-assisted treatment, where you're using medications to stop the cravings, to make people not want to take drugs, I have heard in various shows that we've done on this, Chief Mara, that only a couple doctors are actually certified to do this. Is that another effort that you're making to just get more docs doing this? I know one doc who does it, who has, you know, I don't know, 200 patients or something.
Yeah, the state is trying to get more doctors to get involved.
Are they resistant?
I've talked to a couple doctors, and sometimes it's, hey, I don't want to get involved in that. It'll take away from my practice. And again, the stigma part comes in. I don't really, there are a lot of different reasons. But it's something that's needed in the state, and we need some dedicated physicians to step up and to help the situation.
Well, Molly, thank you for the email, and Tiffany for the call. Again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Chief Mara, I want to go back to your comments about the drug treatment infrastructure. You basically seem to be saying we could build all sorts of treatment facilities and there wouldn't be enough people to staff them. What do you think the lessons are from the recent closure of Serenity Place in Manchester, which was playing a huge role in treatment in that city? What's your take on what might have gone wrong, and what do we pull from that to make our broader statewide treatment infrastructure stronger?
Well, if you look how Safe Station started, there were...
And just remind us what that was, too, please.
There was a firefighter who had a relative that was asking for help. He was at the end of his line. He didn't feel like living. He wanted to get help. He couldn't find any. He calls his relative that's a Manchester firefighter. They talk about it at the station. Chris Hickey and other firefighters say, well, have him come down to the station. They start making phone calls, and they found him a place to go. So in Manchester, because Manchester has the... two hospitals, an excellent mental health network. It has a shelter. It has public transportation. It's a place where people can go to get services. So we've always had people from all of the state come. But people are coming to Manchester and they were on the streets. They were involved with drug use. They are suffering from addiction. And Manchester at the time was getting overwhelmed. So I think it's a fantastic story and such a credit to the firefighters to see a problem, and to come up with a solution. Now, I look at Safe Station in Manchester as being a match unit. It was needed. They were right there in the front lines. But what had happened was that Manchester's was a victim of its own success. It was working, but people from all over the state, 15 different states, were coming there. And it was overwhelming the system, so to speak. Now, Serenity Place was made up of a lot of people that were there. They stepped up. They wanted to help. But they weren't, at the end of the day, they weren't equipped to be able to deal with those numbers. But if, like any program, just like this whole opioid crisis is evolving, Safe Stations has evolved. So now with the help of Families in Transition and a lot of Farnham Center and a lot of different organizations, they are now going to the they have now transformed to better handle the problem, and I believe they're not going to miss a step. But what people should know is that what it illustrated, first of all, with all the people coming there, that there were gaps as far as treatment throughout the state. That's why people come, and you can't blame them. But
sure, and everybody knows where the firehouse is, and everybody recognizes, you know, the firefighter. Whereas drug treatment, it's kind of, ooh, what's that, and where is it, and is it a hospital, and is it a nonprofit? What is it?
Right. So, exactly. And but at this point, we do not want it doesn't do any good for other service providers or people involved with RAPs trying to get people, connect people with service. We were getting that they were just sending them to Safe Stations. And that is the problem. That should not be happening. And I understand why it happens, but that is something that has to change because it'll just overwhelm the system again.
So is Manchester still doing Safe Stations?
Manchester's still doing Safe Stations, yes.
And is it better after this collapse of the treatment provider Serenity Place?
I believe it is. I believe it is because we have a lot of people involved. The mayor of Manchester, the health department, the fire department, treatment providers, like I said, Family in Transition, Farnham Center, Granite Pathways. I can go on and on. And these are people that are trained in the field. They know what they're doing. And I believe that it's going to work more effectively.
Well, and this collapse of Serenity Place, again, due to overwhelming demand. So, you know, people aren't blaming them necessarily. But the executive council looked at this. A lot of lawmakers looked at this and said, wow, what can we learn from this? Let's hear from Executive Councilor Andrew Valinsky talking about the closure of Serenity Place and highlighting what he says is the lack of infrastructure in the state to handle this drug crisis.
For many years, we've tried to not pay the piper on this. And those shortcomings, those underfundings, those efforts to downshift responsibility in some instances are coming back to haunt us.
Do you agree with that, Chief Mara?
I can agree that when this happened, that we were caught off guard and that we didn't have the infrastructure in place. I believe that now things are changing. For instance, we are talking about Safe Station. The governor was monitoring that situation. He recognized that not only were people from Manchester being served, but people from all over the state. I got to tell you that the Department of Health and Human Services, they were key in making sure that treatment and services were not disrupted in Manchester. The alcohol fund was doubled last year.
Still not at the 5% that it's supposed to be, but getting closer.
But the governor advocated it was. We're seeing a lot of signs that things are changing. Who would have thought in New Hampshire we would have a syringe service program? Who would have thought that we would have all these methadone clinics that are there, all the other treatment centers that are here. So we have to build our capacity, but like I said, it doesn't happen overnight. When you mentioned Donald, President Trump, it was very encouraging that during that speech what he was talking about. We're waiting to see what is that going to mean as far as funding. And we're also looking to see that the last time the funding came through with the Cures Act, the last time, it was based on a population equation. And here we are proportionate. At the time, it was second most overdose deaths. But we didn't get it. We didn't get the aid proportionate to that. So there are states out there that are not suffering or not experiencing the issues that we're having. And they got a lot more money proportionately. And it didn't make sense. So we're hoping that the way they figure out how the money is going to be sent is changed.
That's something that Senator Shaheen, I believe, talked to us recently about, the idea that the money, the federal money, is given out based on population. We don't rank very high there. You and others seem to be saying it should be based on how much a state is struggling with this particular issue. So in terms of the drug treatment infrastructure, and we talked about Serenity Place, we don't need to go back there, but just what's the broader message going forward? Let's say Concord decide to adopt safe stations or Nashua. What would be the lesson for them to think about?
Well, safe stations, it depends on it wouldn't work for everybody. Nashua has a successful program that they've modeled, and they've, you know, partnered with Harbor Homes, and they've seen a decrease in emergency room visits, I was told. And they have a system there that's great. It's an integrated healthcare. Somebody comes in to get treated for addiction. They're also looked at by a doctor. They're also a nutritionist, a dentist. They also can go there for detox. There's on the other end is housing. So it all depends on it doesn't work for every community. And let's look at it this way. In a perfect world, I believe we shouldn't be sending our citizens to firehouses. They should be able to walk into a medical facility. So that short term, safe stations is there to as a mass unit.
Yeah, because it's so, again, it's so visible. Everybody knows where it is and so forth.
And with the stigma and everything else that involves with it, people felt comfortable going to a fire station initially. But we have to work on that. We have to make sure that people know this is a disease. When addiction is a disease, it has to do with the effect on the brain that the drugs have. And we have to get that stigma. We have to get it treated like any other disease.
One last question for you, Chief Mara. This comes from Tom in Deerfield, who says the number of people overdosing in the state continues to rise, but access to the state's supply of Narcan has been attributed to lower rates of death in recent months. Will New Hampshire continue to supply communities with Narcan? Tom, thanks for the email.
Yes. Yes, we will. We've distributed a lot of Narcan. We are going to continue to do that. We're always looking for funding sources to be able to do that, but that is something that we are working very hard on. And I can tell you that if it wasn't for Narcan, Narcan is a positive, something that's positive happening in the state. In 2016, we had 485 overdose deaths, probably going to be right around there at this point, but Narcan, if it wasn't for Narcan, those numbers would be through the roof. So that is working as far as saving lives. But people get caught up on the numbers. Rightly so, people losing their lives, don't get me wrong. But that does not measure the problem that we have. It's total overdoses. So if we can cut down on total overdoses, we know we're making progress. So that is the number I think is more important.
Well, Chief Mara, barely scratch the surface. I really appreciate you coming in, and we'll talk to you again. Maybe next time we can talk a little bit more about prevention, what works, because that's an important piece of this too. We didn't get to that today. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's David Mara. Again, he is the governor's advisor on addiction and behavioral health. Coming up, we'll sit down for a few minutes with NHPR's Paige Sutherland. She has been reporting on New Hampshire's addiction crisis for 3 years and has a lot to share with us as well. So that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses?
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the New Hampshire News Roundup, insight and analysis on the latest Granite State news. So send us your emails on the week's news before the program, exchange@nhpr.org. Join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Now, this hour, we're getting some perspective on New Hampshire's drug addiction crisis. We just spoke with drug czar David Mara. With us in the studio right now is NHPR reporter Paige Sutherland. She's done much of the coverage of our Crossroad project about the opioid crisis in New Hampshire. You can join us as well. Again, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Paige, good to sit down with you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been looking at this issue over the past 3 years, Paige. What are some of the biggest changes that you've reported on in that time?
Yeah, I think a lot of change. I mean, when I first came in here, the crisis was just kind of happening. People were losing their lives. And, you know, as you know, today that number has reached about an average of 400 deaths from opioids a year in New Hampshire. And the big changes was when I first got on the beat, it was heroin. Everyone was talking about how, you know, the tale that we've all heard, that you got addicted to prescription pills and then heroin. And now it's fentanyl. That is what most of the cases are. And fentanyl, as you know, is a much potent drug, and it's killing people, and no one knows how much is in it. So when you're really buying heroin on the street, it's fentanyl. So that is the big change that we're dealing with. We've seen carfentanil on the streets, which is, you know, as we know, is meant for elephants. It's a tranquilizer. So that's something that's so deadly and lethal. And the big changes is we've increased our access to the reversal drug Narcan. People can now go to a pharmacist and get that. So we're seeing people use it on each other and saving their loved ones and life. So that's now in more hands. We're seeing needle exchanges in New Hampshire. That's something that, you know, when I first started on the beat, lawmakers were adamantly opposed to it. And now we have one that literally just opened today.
Just opened today?
Just
where?
Opened today in Nashua. They're going to be a syringe service where it's outreach. So you call a number and an outreach worker will come and give you the supplies that you need to safely use these illegal drugs. And the medicine, the science behind this is that basically it stops the spread of diseases. It gives you access to recovery workers. So hopefully you will seek that treatment later on.
Because the argument for a long time, Paige, around needle exchanges and other so-called harm reduction like Narcan was, why are you encouraging people to use drugs? You shouldn't make it easier or safer for people to use drugs.
Exactly. That has been the argument when I started on this beat day one. And that's evolved as since I've been here, is the stigma around addiction. You know, when I first got on the beat, you would hear from lawmakers, policymakers that, oh, you know, they picked up that needle. It's their fault. You know, they should get over it on themselves. And now we've, you know, evolved where the stigma has reduced and people are going, oh, wait, like this is a medical disease. This is a problem that, you know, can't be fixed overnight. And I think that the syringe service is something where we're saying, hey, you have a disease. This is going to help you get better. And hopefully you will stop using that drug further down the pipe.
And so many deaths. So it's hard to turn a blind eye to that. Let's hear a little bit, Paige, from Alyssa Claremont of Nashua Public Health. She says research shows needle exchange programs reduce, as you said, the spread of diseases and eventually help more people find treatment.
It doesn't encourage drug use. It doesn't increase overdoses. It doesn't draw unwanted community members. It doesn't do any of that. It meets people where they are with their disease.
Again, that is in Nashua, Elisa Claremont talking about needle exchange programs there. We should talk a little bit more, too, about Narcan, Paige. That's part of this whole harm reduction movement. But that was controversial, too. You know, if you give people Narcan, the argument went, you'll just encourage them to abuse drugs more because they know they'll be brought back to life.
Exactly. And that's something where when I first started on the beat, that just got passed, that we were able to get Narcan, you know, through a pharmacist. And that was a hard bill to pass. The Good Samaritan bill is something else where that passed where, you know, if you and a friend are in the same room, one overdoses, you can now call the cops and you won't get arrested for that possession charge because you are trying to save a life. It's an emergency thing. So that was also a law that was hard to pass. And going back to Narcan, some of the numbers have come out in Manchester. The use of Narcan by non-medical personnel increased by 400%.
Wow, that's amazing.
In Manchester. In Nashua, another large city, 300%. And so you can look at that at both sides of the coin where some people who are critics of Narcan are saying, wait a minute, you know, why are so many people using Narcan? They're just, you know, using as a safety net. Now more people are using drugs because they know they can be saved by this reversal drug. But then the other side, the medical professionals who are first responders who are responding to these overdoses are saying, this is wonderful. More people are living. That means when we show up to a scene, that person that could have been dead is now alive and we can bring them to the hospital and hopefully get them treatment.
Let's take some calls, Paige. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Alden joins us from Lebanon. Hi, Alden. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I had a question about state funding. Historically, all the treatment programs in New Hampshire have been CAS programs, largely because New Hampshire Medicaid doesn't support them, the services so well. So I was interested in also related to Serenity House. It seemed like it wouldn't. A program like that wouldn't fail because of its own success, unless the patients weren't getting paid for it. That meaning Medicaid wasn't supporting it. I was wondering.
Yeah, let's talk about the money. No, it's a good question, and thank you, Alden. And I was just about to ask you that anyway. So you know, let's talk more about that. The state and federal governments have devoted more money to combat drug addiction, but he asks a good question: where does most of it come from?
I think the big question there that was mentioned a little bit with the drug czar, Chief Mara, was that, you know, with Serenity Place's collapse, this is a good story where when I first got on the beat, we had one of the worst problems for drugs in the state and one of the worst states to fund treatment. So that was a huge problem. That is why our crisis has gone to the proportion that it is because we were statistically, historically not funding this addiction problem, and then it just kind of overspilled. And so now we're trying to build up our infrastructure. So we just kind of infused cash into these treatment, into these providers. But the problem is that you can't do that overnight without having the oversight and infrastructure. So we're kind of seeing those unintended consequences of, you know, reacting during emergency crisis and pouring money into something. We didn't really have that infrastructure ever built. So that's why places like Serenity Place make sense that it collapsed, because you can't just, you know, give money with this high demand and not kind of have the infrastructure to absorb it.
So do most people get drug treatment paid for through private insurance, through expanded Medicaid, through community-based health centers? How does that work, Paige?
So that's a good question. I mean, if you have private insurance, that is obviously the best. That is covered. That is what you want. But a lot of times these people who are in the throes of addiction, unfortunately, have severed ties, have lost jobs. They have to rely on the safety net of Medicaid. And unfortunately, when it comes to Medicaid, like the caller was saying, that not everything is always covered. The beds are limited because obviously these providers want private insurance because that's more money. They get more reimbursement if it's a private insurer as opposed to Medicaid. So really, I mean, without Medicaid, hands down, this problem would be so much worse. So Medicaid is really saving lives and getting people the treatment that they would necessarily never be able to get because they would have to pay out of pocket.
Alden, thank you for the call. Again, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. William sent us an email from Auburn. He says, some states are suing drug companies for being complicit in the opioid crisis. He asks, where does New Hampshire stand on suing a company called Purdue Pharma, which assured the New Hampshire VA medical system that their drugs were not addictive? Did New Hampshire jump in on that multi-state lawsuit?
Manchester and Nashua have jumped in. I mean, they are the largest cities in the state. They have been hit hardest by far. So they have definitely jumped in or saying, I mean, as the chief was also saying, Safe Station, these cities both have Safe Station. And as you kind of heard from his conversation, these are expensive programs. I mean, these are 24/7 wraparound services, multiple providers. You know, a good thing to mention as well is that a lot of people who have addiction have other issues as well, chronic mental health issues, chronic homelessness. I mean, they just need the bare bones basics. So these are expensive people to treat. It takes a lot of money. And so the cities are basically saying, you know, you started this crisis by overprescribing these pills, and we've been spending millions of dollars to try to kind of fix what you created. So that's why they kind of want some justice there.
Well, it's interesting what you say, too. And from what I've read, probably from your reporting, Paige, part of the issue that came up at Serenity Place is that people coming didn't just need, you know, help getting over drug addiction. As you said, they were homeless, they had mental illness. So in a way, hats off to the firefighters for trying to do this. But it seems like it turned out to be just this ginormous problem, which anybody working in this field would say, yes, I could have told you that. I mean, addiction just doesn't come out of nowhere.
No, it's definitely something I think everything looks better in retrospect, right? So the fire department really had a community effort. They saw a problem. They knew that they could offer some help, but I think they just didn't realize once they opened the door who would be coming in and what this entailed. So when I talked to the fire chief, you know, after Serenity Place, you know, it was reported that they were collapsing. He was like, yeah, when we first started this, we just thought we were getting people through the door. We didn't realize kind of how much this would involve. And clearly you saw, I mean, Serenity Place was seeing about 2,000 people in a year through Safe Station. And like I said, these people weren't just addicted to drugs. They had chronic problems that, you know, they needed to just kind of get together and try to do as much as they could.
Let's take another call, Paige. This is Kim on the air. Hi, Kim. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Yes. Hi there. I work in a public school system, and I'm just wondering what we can do to help children in the schools to learn about drug addiction, the dangers, the implications. A lot of our children may be dealing with this with their families. And we do a lot in the public school already, but I didn't know if there was some kind of community programs that could come in, some kind of a program to help kids to really become aware.
And what age are you working with, Kim? What ages are you working with? Kim, I'm just curious, what ages are you working with?
I work with elementary school through fourth grade.
Okay.
But I was just curious what we might have for, say, maybe even starting in the fourth grade.
Sure. I mean, I've heard people say, you know, the younger the better. What are your thoughts, Paige, on this in terms of the reporting that you've done on prevention?
Yeah, definitely. I think, like I said before, that we were a state that was failing to provide the adequate resources towards treatment. We were doing exactly the same, if not more, for prevention. So we really weren't putting money towards prevention. And now, obviously, we've woken up with this crisis and are putting funds to that effort. And, you know, you're seeing that about a year ago, they had a huge youth summit in Manchester. And these were high schoolers from all over the state that came in and rallied to show that, you know, we are going to come to the table. Kids are going to be part of the solution. And you're seeing it in Manchester. There's a big group. They went to a conference in Atlanta, and it trained them of how to talk to your peers if they have problems, how to talk to your peers if they have family members that have problems, how to say no to drugs and make sure that that is the message, that don't do these drugs. This isn't the cool way to be at that age. So I think kids are in New Hampshire are really eager to be part of the solution and really kind of take that on. So you are seeing that now.
Well, it's interesting because at one point, maybe it was about a year ago, Governor Sununu said our prevention programs stink.
He wasn't wrong.
Here's an email. Thank you for that call, Kim. Here's an email from Catherine who says, a big part of the problem in New Hampshire is related to the shortage of qualified psychotherapy providers and the tremendous obstacles to getting licensed and certified to treat people in New Hampshire. We talked to the chief about this a couple minutes ago. Catherine says many other states have parity, but New Hampshire imposes an unnecessary, long, tedious process to become a provider for addiction treatment. This applies to advanced clinical social work, certified alcohol and drug counselors who've already been trained, vetted, certified in other states. Catherine says, is this obstacle on the radar to be addressed? I'm hearing more and more about this, Paige.
No, and it's definitely something that the state is aware of. There are bills right now in session that are trying to make it easier for people who have, you know, LADAC licenses, medical licenses in different states to come to New Hampshire and start working right away. Because as you heard from the chief, we have a workforce shortage. I mean, we can put all the money we want in these providers, but if they don't have the trained personnel to offer these services, then that money is useless. So I think they are trying to make it easier that they have licensure parity. They're trying to make it easier that there aren't as many state barriers and having providers settle here in New Hampshire and offer the services that we need. And going back to kind of to prevention, I think the biggest part here and what where we kind of had some gaps before in our prevention where we were kind of doing this one-off thing, like one session of don't do drugs, it's bad, and then moving on. But what we've learned is it needs to be instilled in our after-school programs, in our student government programs, constantly getting it into kids that drugs are bad, you can't do them, and it becomes part of the culture rather than just kind of a one session a year or one day a year being
the drug assembly, and you can already see them rolling their eyes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we've talked a lot with you, Paige, and Chief Mayor about opioids, heroin, fentanyl, carfentanil. But recently there's been news of another drug making a comeback, meth. The police chief in the town of Merrimack said recently they're really struggling with this. What's going on there?
Yeah, so I think unfortunately what's been happening is, as we've talked about fentanyl really being in heroin now, some users are a little hesitant to use it. I mean, you see on the news 400 people dying, so they're kind of looking, you know, they still want to get that high, but they're kind of looking for something that's a little safer of an alternative. And don't get me wrong, meth is by no means safe, but it doesn't have as many fatalities. Like last year, for instance, more than 300 deaths from fentanyl alone and only 10 from meth. So clearly fentanyl is a little more lethal immediately. Don't get me wrong, meth is still bad, but some of these users are seeking that out as well. And you kind of have that problem in Merrimack because you have Merrimack's geography is between two big cities, Nashua and Manchester. They have gotten tons of state and federal money to really crack down on drugs in these cities. And so people, users and dealers are kind of funneling into these smaller towns. So that's why you got a place like Merrimack where there aren't as many cops on the street. They just did approve a drug unit, but they didn't have one before. So the word on the street for people in that kind of drug activity was you can come to Merrimack and no one will catch you here, and you can still continue your illegal business.
Wow.
When
we played that clip earlier from Denise Roy, the Merrimack chief of police. Well, Paige, I am sad to announce on the air that you're leaving NHPR soon. You've done some amazing work. I'm going to miss you because you've helped us out a lot on this show. So thank you, first of all, for that. What's your next adventure after 3 years of reporting in New Hampshire?
Yeah, so it was a very tough decision. I love NHPR, and it's very sad to leave, but I am actually moving to South America to do some freelance reporting there.
Wow. Which country in South America?
Colombia.
So, okay.
Yeah, so next new adventure, but we'll be sad to go.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, really.
Thank you.
The Exchange team thanks you just from the bottom of our hearts because you've been a huge help.
I appreciate
thanks a
that
lot,
Laura.
Paige. And good luck.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR, and our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at NHPR.org. We're also on Instagram at NHPR Exchange. Check it out for some fun behind-the-scenes photos. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.